Mae'r ras ar eis yn ywyn yn y dacwyn i'r wybi. Ar na dwnaf ac ys sy'n mynd o'r hogel sy'n a has wad as fwynid ac ys yn John McDermott. Tolus syfra sy'n tai John ar stai na ddeis yn sgil te bu chol ys a iw chynnu sy'n iad ac ys ysyn ti'n mynd gael ag lacw ys rwy'n sy'n tai dyn ta ar gysolus sy'n tai ar Tom a Mario yn tiwrn y litr yn hal o wynid. Wel y gael i'ch ratlu agos tan tolus agos. So John, I'd like you to start with, you've got a wealth of knowledge on the murder of Lord Leitrim.
Well, do you want to deal just with the murder of Lord Leitrim, or well, do you want to go through Lord Leitrim's life and why he was murdered?
Exactly.
We can start with the story of Lord Leitrim from roughly, I'm not absolutely sure when he arrived as the third Earl of Leitrim, but I would believe, or going by the length of time he reigned for, I think, in excess of 30 years. He was a cavalry officer in the British Army before that, and had fought in a number of wars and battles, and had been injured or wounded.
And I suppose that's how he was paid. He was given.
Well, I'll come to that in a minute. But I would think that a rough estimate of the time that William Sidney Clements, which was his real name, became the third Earl of Leitrim, would be somewhere in the late 1830s to early 1840s, because he was a man in his 70s. In his middle, coming up in his middle 70s, or maybe older than that, when he was assassinated in 1878. So if he was there 30 years or more, he would have to have arrived somewhere in the late 1830s, early 1840s at the. So he became the third Earl. Now obviously there was two other heirs, but nothing is known about them.
No, nothing is said about
them. There could be lots of reasons for that. The main seat of the Earls of Leitrim is County Leitrim. There is a massive manor house just outside Drumshanbo. They could have had their base there, the first and second Earls. They might have been absentee landlords, as was stated, and at different times that some landlords were up and they had a land steward, or they had somebody looking after the place for them, and they were still over in England or somewhere. But anyway, when Lord Leitrim took over, became the third Earl, the Leitrim estate consisted of most of County Leitrim and a large part of County Roscommon, plus his estate here in Donegal, which consisted Fannet, the parish of Fannet that we know now, the parish of Roskilde, and some hinterlands around that, and also most of what we know now as the Inishowen Peninsula.
He owned all of that?
He owned all of that. And as well as that, he owned the Earls of Leitrim owned houses, streets of houses, in Dublin City as well. And they all stand there. Now, how he came Lord Leitrim, the third Earl, was the first of the Earls of Leitrim to actually make their base here in Donegal, on the banks of Mulroy Bay, about 2 miles outside the village of Kilgart. And the name of the manor house is Manor Bohan. And he was the first of them to make their base there. Now, how they came to be in possession of the Donegal part of the estate, nothing is known about the first or second heirs. Nobody seems to have had any contact in this area or any knowledge of these two men. But obviously there was the first and second heir, because it is said, I have heard it said, that one other possible reason is that they didn't own estates in Donegal. That the estate, or the part of the Leitrim estate that Lord Leitrim had here in Donegal, was a land grant to him by the British Crown. for services rendered
in the wars
and in the battles that he fought, and that's also a possibility, but I'm not absolutely absolutely sure. Mm-hmm. But that was also said, that was, and that he was the first Earl of Leitrim to actually have a stitch in Donegal. The rest of them held it. So he arrived, and from the very start it was quite obvious that he was a cruel, evil, vicious tyrant. From the very start, he ruled, as was said, with an iron fist. His tenants, his tenants, both in Panet and in Roskillian areas and all over, and he's showing them that. When he rented land to them, he didn't rent good land to them. He rented them the poorest of the poor land, bogs, marshy land, which couldn't. And he also rented small portions of land at very high rates. And the size of the farm, the small tenant farms that the tenants had, weren't good enough to produce the top quality produce that they needed to. They weren't good enough to produce the quantity required to sell. And again, when they sold their produce, they actually sold it to Lord Leitrim. There was no opposition. He could name his price. They had to sell whatever produce they made, basically to pay the rent, which left them with very little.
He was leaving them poor.
And he was keeping them downtrodden and poor. They were basically living on starvation rations. Because remember, if they set an acre of potatoes, that acre would have to yield enough potatoes that they would sell to rent, to raise the actual cash to pay Lord Leitrim as rent. It would also have to produce enough potatoes as well to feed the family, and also enough potatoes that they would have a seed stock for resetting next year. And the type of land that he set out to them wasn't capable of doing that. So in order to survive, they had to sell nearly practically all of their produce, corn, potatoes, which would be the main crops, maybe a little bit of wheat or barley, I don't know, but they would have to sell nearly all of their crop, this year's crop, to pay this year's rent, leaving them very little to live on. As I said, it was said that they lived on starvation rations. And he charged them high rents. And everything they had or everything they'd owned, he increased rent. Now, it was a very common practice in his time. Now, most tenant farmers would have one cow, one pig, one breeding sow, and a few chickens. The cow for milk, the sow for to produce young pigs and for sale, and also maybe keep one, and they would kill it and cure it to give them something to eat, and the hens for eggs. It was a common practice that they lived in the house along with the tenant farmers. They didn't have buyers for the cow, they didn't have sties for the pigs, no, they didn't have any. And if they built them, everything they built on their tent, Lord Leitrim increased the rent. So
they were living in poverty.
And I mean, the cows, the pigs and the hens, they lived in the house, in the dwelling house along with the family, because they were trying to keep the rent down as low as possible. We'll come on to it at the three men that killed Lord Leitrim. Now, two of those families, of those men, are still very prominent in Panet.
Now, their names would be Shields.
Well, I'll come on to the names later on when we're talking about. But Michael Herity, who was one of them, who was the actual man that was put in jail for 6 months after Lord, spent about 6 months in Lupert jail. His family still lives there on the farm that they farmed in the time of Lord Leitrim, and they have 6 acres of land. That was what they had. They have more now because they inherited land from other people.
I understand.
And they bought a farm or two, but then they bought the farm next door to them, and it was only 6 acres. when the old brother and sister that lived in the farm next door got too old to run it, they sold it to one of the Herities. The two parents were beside each other, and they weren't related or anything like that.
No.
That's what they had to raise crops and feed their family on. That was the type of man he was. He kept the good ground for himself. He farmed as well. It wasn't that he set out the entire estate to tenants. He farmed large power portions of his own estate here in Donegal, and he kept all the good land. He was also, everything you done, everything a tenant farmer wanted to do, the post had to seek permission from Lord Leitrim before they could do it. Such as they wanted to till a field, they would have to get permission to till the field,
right.
And after getting permission from them, they would have to get permission as to what type of crop they could sow in the field. And if he agreed with them that they would sow potatoes, had potatoes in it, or corn or wheat or barley, but if he didn't, and he told them that they had to set something else, well, that's what they had to do, because if they didn't, he would evict them. That was the way it says. Everything done. If you wanted to set extra ground, extra potatoes or extra corn, you had to get his permission, and it was up to him whether he let you or he didn't. Even as far as getting permission, when a young tenant, the son of a tenant farmer, was getting married, probably he was getting married to the daughter of another tenant, they had to get permission from Lord Leitrim to actually get married. And it is reported that part of the condition for allowing this couple, a couple to get married to each other, was that the bride came to Manor Bohan on her wedding night and spent the night with Lord Leitrim and had sexual intercourse with him on her wedding night. That was a precondition of him giving permission. And that is where one part of where the allegation of, there was allegations of rape and murder laid by the ordinary people, the ordinary tenants, against Lord Leitrim, but he was the law. He was Lord and Master of his estates. He was the law.
And they couldn't do anything.
They couldn't do anything about it, but there was accusations of, there was one way in which rape, forcing a young girl, if it's true, forcing a young girl on her wedding night to come to him and have a sexual interest, spend the night with him in his bed. And these girls had to do that, but it was done against their will, because if they didn't, and their new husband that they got married to that day didn't agree to that, his family would probably be evicted, her family would probably be evicted. So that was the way of it. And that was... And one, if that happened, one can only say that was rape. There's no other word for it. These girls were coerced into it, forced into doing it, and they were doing it against the will, so it was rape. The other way in which a rape allegation, and indeed murder allegation, was laid at Lord Leitrim was that he was supposed to have an eye for good-looking young girls. And on his travels round his estate, he would come to a tenant farm and he would see a good-looking young daughter of one of the tenant farmers, maybe 13, 14, 15, 16 years of age. And he would just say, send her to Manor Bohan to work in my kitchen. And a lot of these girls that went were supposed to have become pregnant while they were in his service, and that he was the father, that he, again, forced them under duress that if you don't, I'll evict your family from their little plot. And a lot of these girls became pregnant. And then he had the problem. He would not stand up and say, yes, I'm the father of this one's child or that one's or the other one's. He had to get rid of them. Two ways that he'd done it. One was that he forced that girl and the son of a tenant, of some tenant or other, to get married to each other. and that young, it was a great stigma when a young girl became pregnant and not married. It was classed as the lowest of the low.
Yeah, it wasn't
sort of
accepted,
that no. That family would then have to carry that stigma all their lives, because the blame would be passed from Lord Leitrim to whoever he forced to marry that young girl, that it was him and not Lord Leitrim. That was one way. But on some occasions, for whatever reason, I don't know, some of these girls weren't married off to somebody, whether they were fairly strong-minded young girls or what, and said that they were going to expose them or not. Those girls that didn't get married and were supposed to be pregnant disappeared without trace. And the accusation was that he got them pregnant and for whatever reason he couldn't get rid of it another, that he had them murdered. Now, he didn't commit the act of murder himself.
Yeah, but he ordered it.
He ordered it, and his henchmen, or his agents as he called them, or body, they done it and disposed of the bodies. There was a number, the stories that I have heard down through the years, I've heard different stories, that they were dismembered and fed to the pigs. He kept a big swine herd or pig herd as well, that they were fed that way. Others that, after being murdered, that these agents took them to isolated parts of the estate, dug a fairly deep grave for them during the hours of darkness, and buried them, and they were never found. They were never found. And there's others said, and this is possibly as good a, if these things happened, I suppose we would talk to, there has to be some truth in what did happen at that time, that they were taken out in Corus or boat and dumped, weighted down and dumped into the sea off Downing's here, or off out where the Mulroy meets the Atlantic, where there was, even they weren't weighted down, the chances of them actually being, bodies being found or washed up is very, very slim. And I know that for a fact, because my father-in-law had a cousin, and I'm married just over 28 years, and a few years after I got married, my father-in-law's cousin was washed off a local fishing boat here out of Downing's, a few miles off the coast, about 2 miles off the coast, and his body has never been recovered to this day. It has never been found. So if they dumped them, and they would know where to dump them, where Corns would take them, they might end up in Scotland or somewhere else, or indeed sharks and other sea creatures got rid of them for them. But those things were said, and that was the way he carried it on.
You had a story about one man called Buchanan that he called.
Oh, well, that was the driver. I'll come from that. That was the driver of the, or the Jarvie of the sidecar, that who was shot.
No, this is a man, a tenant that he came to.
Oh, I didn't know I have a name for, but there was two stories about, as I said, Lord Leitrim, you had to get permission for everything you done. But some of the farmers tried to be cute, if you want to call it, for want of a better way, and set extra ground without Lord Leitrim's permission. And nearly in every case, and did a proper every case, he found out he had land stewards all over the place. There was one family over in, not far from, just about half a mile up the road from the Panet side of the New Bridge. Their names was McElhinney, but the McElhinneys, or one of the McElhinneys, was Lord Leitrim's land steward in that area, the Ballyhearian area, and that there. And the nickname on the McElhinneys was the Brighams. That's what it's called. The house is still there. Dublin man, Solicitor, has it as a holiday home now, bought it. In fact, it's still called Brighams. Well, that goes back to the time of our Lord, or further, when Barabbas, when Pontius Pilate offered to let Jesus go, or Barabbas, and Barabbas was described as a brigand,
right,
a thief and a murderer. And that was the nickname, and that was why they got it, because they were Lord Leitrim's land steward. They were known as the Brighams. So those type of people were dotted all over Parramatta and all over Roscommon and all over his estate, and they would come. And he also had paid informers that would inform to get ordinary people who would inform on their neighbours to get
to earn a few,
rent, or get an easier, or maybe a wee bit of a reduction in the rent, and maybe a bit more lower. And he always found out. You know, nearly in every case he found out, and there were probably hundreds of cases. But two stories that always been told by different people. One, a man set had extra corn seed left over when he set the scrub, and rather than let it go to loss, he decided that he would till a field, maybe not a wild lot, maybe a rood, maybe half an acre at most, and set it. But he didn't get permission from Lord Leitrim. Lord Leitrim found out shortly after he set the field of corn, did nothing, said nothing. And as the corn grew and came near and near the time that the corn was about to start going to ripen and was getting ready to harvest, the tenant became more and more confident that Lord Leitrim hadn't found out, because if he had, he would have done something by this day. But Lord Leitrim had known, and he waited. And when the field of corn was just ready to ripen, he ordered his agents to gather up a quantity of his cattle. The cattle were driven to the field, and the gate was opened, and the cattle were entrapped in it and destroyed the entire field. The other story was very similar, only it was potatoes. A man set an extra portion of potatoes, whatever size. Lord Leitrim came along, the potatoes, it was early in the year, this time of year, the potatoes had just, the tops were nicely above the ground. The potatoes themselves weren't made in the ground, the tops. Yeah. But Lord Leitrim went to the tenant, told him to go and dig the extra amount that he had set up and destroy them, and to sow grass seed and on the field and return it to grass, and that he would call back later in the year, and he expected to see grass growing in the field. And the poor tenant in both cases had to accept it, because the tenant certainly that had to re-sow would have done it, because he was facing eviction probably anyway. But if he hadn't done it, he would have certainly been evicted. And probably the man that set the extra bit of corn that Lord Leitrim destroyed the field could have been facing eviction, because anything at all, the minors of things that you, if you went against Lord Leitrim at all, well, you were evicted.
So you heard of a lot of families in your
area? Oh, there was, yes. There was one family, and again, the Parham is not far from the far side of the bridge. They're actually far out relations of mine. Their name was McAteer, and they owned a Parham just on the other side of the new bridge. Or they were renting, that's what. And they were evicted. Why, I don't know. But they had an uncle or grandparents who lived in Dawbeg, which is down near Bannet Lighthouse on the far the other side, and they moved in with either an uncle or the grandparents, and that's where they're based today. The McAteers are still there, the family there. Yes. And that was before 1878 that they were evicted, because there was no evictions afterwards. I don't think that the fourth heir
was as cruel,
and whether there wasn't evictions, but he done things a different way. Mm. You know, some people classed it still as evictions, but I'll come on to that maybe at the end of the story. But certainly the fifth and sixth heirs didn't evict any, because there's a story about them as well. Well, and I can go through it later on. But they were evicted, and it had happened before Lord Leitrim was assassinated in April 1878. And then when the treaty and the pre-state, the Irish pre-state, was formed in 1919 by 1921, the tenants, such as my people, and I have the deed of my house, and everybody that owned my farm since 1921 is on it. My granduncle, who owned it, was the first owner, got title to it from the late Lord Leitrim estate, right down to my father after him, my mother after my father died, and then now myself. All four names, all names are on it. And at the top of the my deeds, it states, from the estate of William Sidney Clements, 3rd Earl of Leitrim in the barony of Kilmacrenan, to, and it goes to Henry McDermott sometime in 1921, and that was when the Irish
Free State
handed over title of land of the to the tenants when they took charge of it, and that. So they had been they were living down in Dalbeg, but when in 1921 they actually were given back their farm in Leahate over the other side of the bridge.
So did they move back up?
No. They did farm it for up until roughly the sometime in the 1960s, and the then owner of it decided he sold it, and a local man over there bought it. But they were evicted from their farm before Lord Leitrim was assassinated. And in 1921, when the Irish Free State started giving title to the tenants who were renting from it, they actually got their farm back some 41 odd years later. So that's really the only person that I would have known to be evicted. But I mean, the stories were telling, there was no names. There was hundreds of people.
Of course there were, yeah.
Evicted for no reason at all. No. It could be that there were, even stories were said that you would have although they would probably have no education, couldn't read, couldn't write or anything else, you would have still brainy people.
Of course it is, smart. Yeah.
And some farmers were more productive than others, and they would go out and they would gather stones and they would drain their land and one thing and another. It was said that if Lord Leighton came along the road to his estate and he saw a field of corn or a field of potatoes or a field of something or a good quality cow or maybe a good quality bull, and he thought that field or that cow or that was producing better quality stuff than he would confiscate the whole thing. He would confiscate the field off the farmer for his own use. He would confiscate the cow, he would confiscate the bull. If they had horses and they had a top quality horse, he would confiscate the horse off them.
So really, John, would it have been just over years that hatred had built up?
It was accumulation. And as I said, from the very start, there's no doubt about it, that from whatever time he came, that he set out from day one, and there's nothing else, that he was a vicious, cruel, evil man, tyrant. He was described as a tyrant, and that's what he was. So those are just a summary of stories, but I mean, there's thousands of stories, and if you talk to other people, they would tell you completely different stories, but basically on the same line. Yeah. So then we move on then to the middle, say the middle. I don't actually know when an official date for the infamous Glenray evictions took place, but the reason that was it a dare.
John George Adair.
Adair was the landlord that he evicted everybody off, was to turn it into the deer pack, basically, that we know that's there with Glen Bay cattle today. Sometime in the couple of years before Lord Leitrim was assassinated, he decided that he was going to do the same thing, but he was going to have two deer packs. First deer pack, he was going to evict everybody in his own and turn the entire peninsula in his own into a deer park. And the second deer park was that he was certainly going to turn the entire parish of Fannet, plus I would have to say Roskilde here and maybe other areas, into a deer park, or a big portion of it into a deer park, and evict everybody north of the. He was going to build a high fence to contain the deer within it when he money which talking about, and he was going to evict everybody in between. And that was basically the final straw that pushed the hand up, especially the Panet people, in to assassinating Lord Leitrim. And when the word got out that he intended to evict everybody in Panet and others, and evict everybody in his own, and turn both areas into deer parks, sometime in early 1878, a meeting was held in a barn belonging to a family named McGrenahan in a place called Gorton the Tra. It's down along the Mulroy on the Panet side, across from Melmore, down here at the point of Downing, not across just across. And it was said that at that meeting that a representative from every tenant, one member of every tenant family in Panet attended that, and that there was approximately 200 or more people at it. It was decided at that meeting that Lord Leitrim had to be stopped, or he would evict everybody in Panet. And they decided that the only way they could stop him was to kill him or assassinate him. At that meeting, it was decided then that they would have to get somebody to do it, and it would have to come from, the people who were going to do it would have to come from the meeting, the body of the meeting there that night. So, rather than ask for volunteers, because I would say the figure that nearly everybody there would have put their hand up if they had asked for volunteers, they decided they would put their all the names that, of the people that were there in a hat, and that they would draw a tree. But before that, Michael McAwee spoke up, and he said that they could draw out as many as names as they wanted, but he was going to be one of the people that...
He elected himself.
He volunteered.
Yes.
And he called at that stage for two good men to go along with him. He kind of decided on three men to carry out the deed. And nobody volunteered, so the other two names was then drawn out at Michael Herity and Neil Shields, or and Tiller Moore, as he was known. Both Michael Herity and Neil Shields were tailors by trade, and Michael Wee was supposed to say, after the two names were said, "I asked for two good men and look what I got." Now, that was not casting any aspersion really on the two men that came out of the hat, but it was more to do that with the fact that the type of business that both of them of tailoring, there was no sewing machines. Everything was done by hand. They worked from early in the morning to late at night, whereas the other tenants were out and about. They would have guns, flintlock rifles and that, and they would be out, as they used to say years ago over in Panet, fowling, out trying to shoot a duck.
Hunting,
a rabbit or a hare or a wild duck or snipe or moorhen or woodcock or that type of stuff to augment their meagre diet. And as lead shot, or they would only be using one ball, which they would make themselves out of molten lead, they could, was at a premium. And gunpowder, which they needed to buy, was at a premium. When they fired a shot at something, they really had to kill it. So they had to be reasonably good marksmen, because they couldn't afford to be missing if you were going out and firing three shots and killing one, taking three shots to kill something for the dinner the morrow, you had to be able to kill with a push shot. You couldn't waste, because they didn't have the money or anything like that to buy, but so it was at a premium. So, but the tailors, the two, Herity and Shields, because they were tailors, wouldn't be known for their marksmanship, and that was...
That's what he meant.
That's what he meant.
Yeah.
Because they would be housebound more times, whereas a lot of other people that could have been drawn out were would be reasonably proficient marksmen.
Yeah.
You see, with a gun, with a rifle, and they weren't, and this is what he meant. So now they had decided they were going to assassinate Lord Leitrim. They had the three men, Michael Herity, Neil Shields, and Michael McGowey. The three men then set about planning their attack on Lord Leitrim. The first thing that they got the services of one of the Lord Leitrim's maids to feed them information about his movements, and she kept feeding them information, and they would decide when and where they would attack based on her information. They also Lord Leitrim, basically, I presume he was taking his cavalry and his army experience. And when Lord Leitrim travelled around his estate on estate business, he never returned the way he went. He returned a different way.
He made sure of that.
Yes, yeah. And he wouldn't tell his entourage that would be travelling with him, his bailiff, his driver, and which way they were going until they were leaving, say, Manor Bohan in the morning. And when they were coming home, it was only at the last minute when they were leaving, wherever they were, he would tell them what route to take home. So information couldn't be. He always feared, because of the man, that
he knew he was in danger.
Yes, he knew he was always in danger, and there was always the possibility that he would be attacked and an attempt would be made on his life. So he used his military experience. He never travelled the same way twice. He never travelled to somewhere and returned the same way. He would return another way. And he never told any of his entourage which way they were going, or indeed maybe where they were going in the morning, until the last possible moment, until he had to, when they were leaving. We're going to Letterkenny, we're going to Creasley, we're going to Panet. But they wouldn't then be able to get any information or give information to somebody that would pass the information to other people, so that an ambush could be laid for him somewhere. So when Shields and the three men were chosen to carry out or attempt the assassination attack on Lord Leitrim, they secured the services of the servant girl to feed information to them as to his movements and his impending movements. And knowing that it was going to be difficult to judge which way Lord Leitrim would travel or where he was going, and hard to get accurate information on his travel movements, they decided that they would, and they decided on what type of terrain they wanted. The type of terrain that they wanted that would give them the best advantage and opportunity to launch an attack on Lord Leitrim and make an escape. Now, as Lord Leitrim got older, in his younger days, and when Lord Leitrim travelled round on a large white stallion, on horseback, but as he got older, the wounds that he had received in his military career were bothering him and giving him trouble, and he basically couldn't ride, or he was in a great deal of pain if he rode on horseback. So he, towards the end of his life, he travelled round by sidecar. So they knew that he would be travelling by sidecar. So the type of terrain that they wanted was a piece of road with a fairly steep brae or hill, where the horse pulling the sidecar would have a heavy pull and would have to slow. The sidecar would slow down, given, and also the driver or the jarvie wouldn't be able to quicken the horse up into a gallop and speed away from them. So they went out looking, and they identified a number of places, and one of these places was about 2 miles, or a mile and a half to 2 miles, on the Cranford side on the Milford side of the road from Cranford to Milford at a place called Bunyan or Cattle Wood. And as the name means, it was a heavily wooded area and the road went through the woods. So some days before, or maybe a week before it, information was passed from their spy, the young maid and servant girl in Manabohan, that Lord Leitrim had procured between 30 and 40 eviction notices for Tennyson and his own, mainly around the Greencastle area, and that was supposed to be the start of him clearing and his own, to turn in his own the entire peninsula into a deer park.
Just evict the whole.
Yes, similar to the Glen Bay evictions. Yeah. He got 30 or 40, and it was one area. He was clearing that little area out when he went. If he had got that day and served them, he would have cleared that little area around, somewhere around Greencastle. Out that day, that whole area, everybody would be gone. Their houses, and there would be very poor quality houses, would be burnt once they were put out. They'd be put out on the street and torches, but there'd be thatch roofs and whatnot. The houses would be burnt and left unlivable, and they could, yes, so they were gone. So that information came to the three men post. That was a number of days before the 2nd of April. Then a couple of days before the 2nd of April, the young girl was able to pass the information to them that Lord Leitrim had planned to leave at about 6 o'clock on the morning of the 2nd of April, 1878, to travel via Cranford, Milford, Rathmullen to Rathmullen by sidecar, and cross Loch Swilly from Rathmullen by boat to Buncrana, where he would meet up with his agents and his bailiffs and that land stewards and whatnot in his own, and they would have transport laid on, and they would travel on from there to whatever part of his own around Greencastle to serve these eviction notices or execute these eviction notices. So they knew then that now they had a date for him travelling, and the only road possible that he could travel on that morning was the Kerrygart Milford Road and on into Rathmullen from Milford, because he was on a strict timetable, you see. It was slow movement, even on a sidecar, and that, and time consuming, travel was time consuming. So he had to take the nearest route, and the nearest route from Manorbohan to Rathmullen was through Cranford, Milford, and then on into Rathmullen. So he'd have to travel that road. They had the site at Cattlewood already earmarked as a possible. So they set about organising themselves, getting their guns ready. They had two rifles and two handguns, flintlock pistols and flintlock rifles. They set about gathering up whatever lead they could to make lead shot, and gather up as much gunpowder as they could as well. And they didn't have one, because I think all told they had only about six lead bullets or balls for the guns and for the handguns and the rifles when they actually launched the attack. They had very few anyway. So they all gathered again, and this was all done in McGrinahan's barn where the original meeting took place, and they were there. So it came to the, so Herity was there and his rifle, but the butt on his rifle was either badly cracked or part of it was broken off, and Herity decided that he would cut, it was cut and carved out of a piece of green timber, so possibly they went out to a tree, cut a branch that was thick enough, that would give him enough, and he carved a new wooden bungot or butt for the gun, for the rifle, with a knife. But it was a crude bit of carving. Yeah. And when he went to fit the timber gun butt to the iron part of the gun, there was gaps between the iron work and the timber. And he didn't have time to make a a perfect job of. So one of the young McGrenahan girls had been attending school, and there was copybooks of hers that had been completed, and they were left out the barn, out of the road. And he started tearing pages and pieces of pages with her handwriting and her name and everything.
And stuffed it in.
And stuffed it in the gaps between the ironwork and the timber part of the gun. And he then decided that he needed to give it a coat of paint, or look paint. And the only paint that was available was a bright red paint. So he painted the butt of the gun red, the timber part, supposed to preserve it against dampness. So they had their plans made. They also had their plans as to how they were going to travel to it, and that was. Yeah. But then on during the day of the 1st of April, the day before, a spanner was put in the works. A servant was dispatched to a blacksmith shop in Kerrygart, Paddy Lowe's blacksmith shop in Kerrygart. He would have a sidecar and horse and sidecar, one or maybe two. The Rosapenna Hotel, the original Rosapenna Hotel that was burnt down, was built by and owned by Lord Leitrim in the beginning. And the gentry used to come and stay there. And Paddy Lowe, they would rent these, Paddy Lowe, this Paddy Black, would rent a sidecar out to the gentry. They would go around visiting, looking at some of the local beauty spots in the area. And when the servant came in to try to hire a second sidecar from Logue's, Paddy Logue, from Logue's Blackman, he was informed that he didn't have one. The only one they had was out on with visitors, but that it would be back later that evening, and Lord Leitrim could have it then. So the young servant girl found this out, and she managed to get in contact with somebody that was from Pannet, that was travelling from Kerrygart back to Pannet, and get him to give a message to the three men that it wouldn't be one sidecar would be travelling the following morning, but two, and there would be a party of six. Because he was taking two bodyguards for some reason or other, whether he had got something in wind or not. He usually travels himself, driver, and his bailiff, and him and his bailiff would be heavily armed with two sidearms or handguns, and they also had a couple of loaded rifles close to hand on the sidecar. But on this occasion, he decided that he was going to take a couple of agents with him, and agents were basically bodyguards for him, and they would also be having that. There was too many for one sidecar, so they had to have a second sidecar, and they were hired. So this word was conveyed to Herity, Shields and McAlee. Now, there was no way that three of them, poorly armed, with poor ammunition and whatnot, could attack a party of six, and four of them heavily armed men, and what to do? Should cancel it, call it off, go ahead with it? They didn't know, but they wanted to get it over and done with, basically for two reasons. The first reason was, and probably arrogant, they were afraid that somebody would blabber, spill the beans.
Information would leak.
And that it would get to Lord Leitrim, and that they would be arrested, tried, and probably hung, even though for just planning to do it, and that, and their families would be executed. The other reason, and probably another valid reason too, was these were not hardened fighters. If you take them in the context of what me and you would have known this last 40 years in Northern Ireland, the paramilitaries, yes, hardened men to their job. These were ordinary men, family men. And I suppose they were also afraid that the longer it took for to actually get the job done, they would lose their nerve. So somebody came up with an idea that even if there was two sidecars, if the second, now it was always known that Lord Leitrim, being a cavalry officer, he led from the front. So, you know, he would be in the first front. He wouldn't travel behind somebody else, another sidecar. So he was going to be in the first sidecar car with his bailiff and his driver, Buchanan, young Buchanan. And his two agents and another servant from Manor Bohun of Lourdes was to drive the second one. So they came up with the idea that if some way could be found that they could bid distance, that they could slow the second sidecar down, slow it down, and allow a distance between the two sidecars, that would allow them enough time to attack Lord Leitrim and escape, that they would go ahead with it. So a person from Bannet was dispatched back to Kilgart to Logue's blacksmith shop, and now Paddy Logue and a young apprentice blacksmith from Fannett by the name of Peoples was brought onto the loop. They tried to keep only as few people in the know as possible, but now they needed Logue's, Paddy Logue's and the young Peoples' help to do something to the horse. And the idea was that a nail to be put in one of the horse's hoofs wrongly, and that after the horse would travel a starting distance, that it would start, the nail would start hurting the horse and that the horse would go lame. Paddy Lowe, who, like most other people, hated Lord Leitrim, readily agreed, and he said that he would be able to sort the horse out to help them. The messenger that went back told the three men, it was all right. Later on that night, the servant, Lord Leitrim's servant returned, expecting to pick up the horse and sidecar from Logue's and stable, and they were going to stable the horse in Manor Bohun overnight, before ready for 6 o'clock the following morning. But Paddy Lowe told him that when the horse was out earlier in the day on its sightseeing, the sightseers, that it had cast a shoe, and that the other shoes weren't great, and that he would have to reshoe or have the horse reshod. Now, whether he did or he didn't, that was the excuse, but he did guarantee the servant that he would have the horse in sidecar at Manor Bohun at 6 o'clock the following morning. And it fell to young Peoples, the apprentice, to put the nail in the wrong way.
So it was him who put the
nail in? Yes, because his great-grandson told me that not so long ago, that it was his great-grandfather put the nail in the shoe. Now, funnily enough, the Peoples were Protestant people. They were Catholics.
Well, he wasn't good to all the Protestants.
He wasn't good to all the Protestants either. And the Peoples still live in Glensk, about a mile below the bridge there. When you go over the bridge, you go up to a crossroads about a quarter of a mile up from the Bannet side of the bridge and turn left, and about half a mile down the road, this man's grandson still lives there in their original house, Peoples. So the nail was put in wrongly. The horse was delivered before 6 o'clock, and the was delivered to before 6 o'clock, ready for Lord Leitrim set up. But over in Bannet, the three men, during the hours of darkness, or the early hours of the second, left McGranahan's. They walked up to Ballyhearin, and this was their plan. And they arrived at a place near to Ballyhearin called, the proper name is Seamount, but it's locally known as Bog. And
that's close to your place, John?
Well, it'll be about a mile and a half away from me, but it's on the banks of Mulroney, where across from Dublin Rea. And there was a number of families, but one family by the name of Griffin had a boat, and the three men took Griffin's boat, rowed across to Dublin Rea on the Cranford side, or the Kerryard side, or Mulroy side, or of Mulroy Bay, took a second boat from there and came back over to Bog and returned Griffin's boat. They weren't stealing the boats or anything like that. They wanted her, and knowing that the Gripens depended on their boats, they returned it. And they used the second boat then to cross over the Mulroy again, and they travelled up along the Cranport shore up on, and came ashore just below where they had chosen the place they had chosen to launch the attack on Lord Leitrim. It was a steep hill, and the horse coming towards the brow of the hill would be travelling very slowly and couldn't quicken up and get away from
and a wooded area.
So they got out of the boat, went and under the cover of the wood head just about dawn on the morning of April the 2nd. At about 6 o'clock, Lord Leitrim, his bailiff, his driver, the two agents and the other driver left Manor Bohan, two side cars, Lord Leitrim in the lead, three side car, and when they were approaching Cranport, which was about 3 miles away or more, the second side car started to fall back. The horse was starting to go lame. Lord Leitrim waited. Lord Leitrim waited until the sidecar came up, and when he was informed that the horse was lame, he decided that himself and his bailiff and his driver would proceed on as planned to Rathmullen, and meet up with his people on the Buncrana side or the Neshone side as planned, and that his two agents and the driver of the sidecar was lame, that the horse was lame, would travel on to Milford, and when they get to Milford, they were to procure a replacement horse, travel on to Rathmullen, and then travel across and meet up with Lord Leitrim later that day in and around the Green, whenever they could get there in and around the Green Kettle area. That was the plan. So off the two sidecar sets again. The second car, sidecar, starts to slow to fall behind. And about a mile and a half, 2 miles outside of Cranford, Lord Leitrim, his agent, and young Buchanan, the driver, arrive at the spot, and the three men launch their attack. There's something that I have to add in before that. Lord Leitrim is on his way from Manor Bohan in the same manner, and the horse goes late, but there's another spanner put in the works of the three men while they're waiting in Cressa. A man comes from the walking along the road from the Cranport direction, and they watch him and they pass, allow him to pass. They allow him to pass and to go on some distance. They didn't know whether it was an ordinary man going about his business, some business or other, or whether it was whether Lord Leitrim had gone to wonder of something, and that was somebody going ahead of the road and had some way of warning Lord Leitrim if he saw anything, that there was possible danger ahead. So Michael Wee was dispatched to follow this man, and he followed this man on foot for a considerable distance towards Milford until he was satisfied that this man was just an ordinary man going about his own business and had nothing to do with Lord Leitrim, and then he returned to join his comrades. And just as he returned, Lord Leitrim's sidecar came into view, and they allowed it to come on onto the point where they decided this was where they were going to make their attack, and they fired a volley of shots. First of all, they killed the driver, young Buchanan, outright. They seriously wounded Leitrim's bailiff, and they inflicted a minor flesh wound in one of Lord Leitrim's shoulders. But Lord Leitrim never travelled, no matter where he travelled, he always wore his body armour, his cavalry body armour underneath his coat, or as they called it then, his cloak. And it was always said that he either had his cavalry helmet fixed in, you saw pictures of the type, the gentry wore big, very big, tall top hats. That he had either helmets made into the hatch when they were made, or that when the hatch was made, that there were steel plates around and across the top so that they would protect them from a heavy blow to the head. That was it. So the morning of the second paper was a very cold, frosty morning, and then in the dampness of the wood, they had great trouble in keeping their powder dry. So when they reloaded again, some of the guns misfired, and by this time Lord Leitham had alighted from the sidecar and had returned fire with his two hand pistols, but he hit none. So with the guns out of action, the three men attacked Lord Leitham, and as he was a cavalry officer in his time, he was used to hand-to-hand combat, and although he was an old man, he was a very big,
strong man,
and they had considerable trouble getting him. They needed to get him off his feet, and they had considerable trouble getting him off his feet, but eventually they did, and McAwee and Shields held him, and Hardy smashed his skull in with the butt of his gun, but as he did so, the new butt that he had put broke off. By this time, the second sidecar had come into view about a quarter of a mile away. And when those two agents saw what was happening in the Tekuna, they got off the sidecar and ran towards the scene. On seeing them, they gathered up what they could, their guns and whatnot,
and ran,
and made their escape. They're back to the boat, and they crossed, straight across the Mulroy, to a place about 2 miles below Milford on the Milford Kirkgale Road, called the Hawk's Nest, and they came ashore there. Now, I don't know whether they left all of their guns that they had in the boat, but certainly, and this is where Hardy was placed and managed to get arrested some days later, his broken gun was definitely left in the boat. Remember, he broke the gun, the butt off. Yeah. All he had with him in the boat was the iron, the muzzle, and the firing mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was left in the boat, because I don't really know why or how or what information the authorities got to arrest Erte. The other two men were never arrested, but obviously they found something that connected the gun or something to Erte.
Well, they may have found the butt of the gun that was...
Yes, oh, they did. Yeah. Well, from they came ashore on the below Milford, they travelled through the house to a place called Greenport, where it said that they went into what passed then as a pub.
Shebeen.
And there's a couple of things there. And that Shields, and that they split up there. Greenport is about half a mile on the Kirkheel side of Portsound. And that they split up there, Shields and McAwee headed across to Rosnakill, where they were supposed to go into another pub and have a few drinks before Neil Shields headed over 2 miles to Morris, to his own home, and Michael McAwee headed down to Balawarski, to his home, where he was brought. But Hardy, when he split up with them in Greenport, he went down to below Portsound to a place called Dochraban, to a house by the name of Porsky. And this house he used from time to time to carry on his tailoring. He would arrive, spend a day or two, it would be known what time of the month or what time every 3 months or every 6 months he would come, and the local people would leave clothes that they wanted mended, or maybe get new clothes made if they could afford it, and he would come to Horsky's house and he would stay there until whatever tailoring jobs he had to do was done, and then he would return. So to set up an alibi for himself, that's what he done. He arrived at Horsky's and that he was there tailoring and not in Mullion or on Craftywood killing Lord Leitham.
But Hardy was the only one arrested.
And that. So back at the scene, the authorities and the RIC, who had been in it, would have been there at that time, was alerted. They arrived. Leitham was dead. Buchanan was dead. And his agent was, or his bailiff was, seriously injured. The bodies of the two dead people, Lord Leitham and Buchanan, were removed to Milford, and obviously the bailiff was taken to receive medical treatment. And I think he actually survived, although he was fairly seriously injured. He survived the attack. But the authorities in Milford, they were at a loss to know what to do. Because they knew it was he was a hated man, and they also knew what do we do about it? He's murdered. What do we do about it? Because if we arrest somebody, it could cause a tenant's revolt, something similar to what happened up in Mayo with Captain Boycott. So they waited. They sent word to Dublin. Dublin didn't know what to do. Dublin Castle. They sent word to London. Questions were asked in the Parliament about it, and by the time that the word came back, the British authorities didn't want to do anything about it. But in the intermediate time, on the day of thing, the gun butt was found, the broken gun butt painted red, the pages of the copybook and the torn pages of the copybook was, and the young McGrannan girl, she was a 13-year-old girl whom the copy belonged to, her name was actually in some part of it. So they arrived in McGrannan's in Gortatá, and they arrested the three McGrannan men, the father and two sons. And later they arrested Herity. The McGrannan's was held, I would presume, in Lippert Jail for about 3 weeks, and they were released without charge. Herity was still in jail. The British authorities wanted the whole thing to die a death, because they didn't want it to, but the aristocracy or the other landlords around were pressurising them, because they were afraid that
they were in danger now.
If this crime went unpunished, that they could be next. Mm. So they wanted the whole thing to die a death if they could, but how to do it? They had Herity and they had some evidence or that linked him to the crime, but possibly not enough to convict. So
he was jailed for.
He was about 6 months in Lippert Jail, and next thing, he was supposed to have died of the fever. Contracted the fever in Lippert Jail and died, and his body, in a coffin, was returned to his parents, his family in Fannet, and he's buried in the Herity plot. His name's on a headstone in the Herity plot, in Mashman Graveyard, over just beside Tamney, and he was supposed to die in Lippert Jail of the fever. But it is a well-held view that the British authorities smuggled him out of Lippert Jail, paid his passage to America, where he lived till he was in his 80s, and that in the coffin, that there was nothing but stones in the coffin that was buried in Mashman Grave. In the grave in Mashman, and there are people in Panet who had people who emigrated to America, probably New York, not in the early part of the century, who on writing home said that they had actually met Michael Herity and knew him in America, and he was supposed to live till he was a man in his 80s, but he never returned.
He never returned.
So that's basically the story of Lord Leitrim and his assassination.
I would say
a big part of luck held on it, because they weren't all that well.
They weren't well armed.
Because if they had been long to, well, the paramilitary body that would have been in part of Ireland would have been the Fenians that day.
Yeah.
Now, if it had been a Fenian orchestrated attack, I would have presumed that they would have been far better. They would have been trained in some way
before
they
were dead,
and they would have been far better armed, both with more up-to-date guns and ammunition, because at that stage, although the Plintlock rifle was an obsolete weapon, and it was the only reason that they had it. Nobody wanted them, and they were probably being given away for nothing.
They were
getting the breech loaded rifle, the one shot where you the breech what's the bullet,
right.
What's the bullet intact as we would know it,
right.
And loaded not a breech load. The breech is where the chamber where the bullet actually stays in a rifle, not the barrel. That's the muzzle. That's known as the muzzle. They know how you see in these old films where they lift the top of the rifle up and they stick a bullet in and close it, fire it, and then lift it again and put it, replace it. Yeah. Those type of bullets was in for the Army and whatnot and the RAC and you know, all those at that time. And the front lock was or the type of guns they had where they had a poor, put the lead shot or pellet down gun, ram it in with a with a ramrod, put powder down, put a wad of cloth down, and then prime the pan at the back with another little bit, and they had the wee piece of cord that was steeped in some sort of solution that would keep it just smouldering, that the cord, and then fire it to ignite the thing. Those type of things were outright. So they were very lucky that they actually managed it.
But John, you got to credit them.
Yeah, you haven't got to credit them.
They planned to do it very well,
and they got away with it.
And then Fanon people kept it very quiet.
Oh yes. Because there was a story that. I'll come on to the 4th Earl and the 5th Earl very, and the 6th Earl, correct. There's not a wild lot to tell about them, but there is a few things in a minute. There was a story that there was an IUC sergeant in, there was an IUC station in Rosnakill, in Pamet. That would be near to my house where you were one other day. And there was a sergeant there, and he was a bit fond of a drink. And there was a small pub cum shop, and there was, the counter was on two levels. The shop counter was low, and the bar counter was 2-3 feet higher, and you sat on stools a couple of feet higher. So the sergeant was supposed to be in having a drink this evening in this Carr's pub in Tamley, and a local man who was described as a simpleton was supposed to come in, and he started blabbering about and naming the boys that killed Lord Leitrim. Now the Kerrs that owned the pub were Protestant people again, and when old Kerr who was in the pub heard what was going on and couldn't get it stopped, he got somebody, told someone to go down, and the priest's house, the canon's house, was about 150 yards down the road from the pub, and he told somebody to go down and tell the cabin what the canon, Catholic canon, what was happening up in the pub, that so and so was there and he was spilling the beans on the boys, and that the sergeant was listening and taking Dahl in. So whoever went down to the canon told him, don't worry, when the canon was told what was happening, go back up and tell Wooly, or William was a common name in Carr's, go back up and tell Wooly Carr not to worry, the sergeant might know about it, but he'll never tell. So back up in the pub, this man described as a simpleton who knew no weather, that was supposed to be on the boons, when the parish sergeant, he was sitting on the low part of the counter, feet off the ground, with the floor, he was sitting on the low part of the counter, jumped down just before, and he says, when he felt he had enough information, I have enough information now to get the boys that done it, and I'll have them. And with that, he was supposed to step down off the counter, or jump down off the counter, and he was supposed to drop dead of a heart attack when he hit the floor.
Power of the priest, just
power that people believed that was the power of the priest, because the priest said he might know,
but he won't tell
to go back up and tell Wooly Carr not to worry, he might know who killed Lord Leitrim, but he'll never tell. So whether them true or not,
but they're in the folklore, they're the story, they're in the story.
Well then, do you want to stop or do you want to go on?
We haven't got much time left, but
well, very quickly.
Yeah, you go on.
The 4th Earl came then. Now he was a distant cousin of Lord Leitrim. The 4th Earl came then, and he was a distant cousin, and he was from the industrial north of England, and he was he would have been a businessman or a business minded or orientated anyway. And he looked at, the first thing he done was he found out how many tenants was on, he had on the estate here in Donegal. He come to the conclusion that there was far too many tenants. He also looked at the size of the land and the type of land that they had, and he that they couldn't produce the stuff to pay him his rent. It was a business. And also that the size of their farms and the type couldn't sustain the number of people that was actually in each family living on. He took a census of the number of people actually living on, and the farms weren't big enough or capable enough of producing enough produce to, for the farmer to, or for the tenant to pay him his rent fairly comfortably and still have enough left to feed his family and do whatever else he needed. So he came up with the idea that any family who wished to emigrate to America, he would pay their way to America, their passage. But a lot of people branded him similar to Lord Leitham, where Lord Leitham went bull moose, pushed out, I'm going to evict everybody. Mm. And they were suggesting that he was doing it in a sly way or by the back door. Well, possibly he was, possibly he wasn't, but he wasn't going to evict everybody. He was going to reduce the number of tenants and up the size of the tenant farms to a size that he felt that they could produce enough to pay him his rent quite comfortably and still have enough left over. So, but he was being tarred with the same brush as as what went before him when he tried this, although a number of sizable amount of people did take up his offer, the offer of a new life in America and go to America. Yes, and that, but he didn't live all that long. The fifth Earl came then, and he must have been from a farming background or had some sort of thing, because the Granny Mower, which was the famous Leitrim sailing ship, was plying its trade between Downingtree or Mulroy or wherever, Downingtree probably, Sheephaven, from Sheephaven Bay to Liverpool and to Glasgow. And when the fifth Earl came, he went out around his tenants and he informed them about, he brought in, introduced them to different varieties of seeds, potatoes, producing bigger crops.
Yeah.
And he also introduced them to fertilisation. In my young days, the fertiliser, Juana it was called, it was made from the droppings of the birds on the Galapagos Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, he introduced them to fertilising their ground, draining their ground, and he helped them.
Yeah,
he brought in breeding stock.
He started to improve.
He started to improve the whole thing. And when he died, he's buried in the grave, Church of Ireland graveyard up there. There was genuine sadness and sorrow among his tenants because of what he done. And when the sixth Earl came, he carried that out. He's also buried up there. And the same thing at his funeral in Garrigard.
Right.
So that's as far as the Lord Leitham goes. There was the sixth Earl was the last Lord Leitham.
Well, thanks very much for your time, John. But we've just got 1 minute left on this recording now.
Yeah.
So, but I do appreciate your effort and
your
knowledge and coming across the bridge and everything.
Yes,
John, we'll do more.
They're not as long-winded as the Lord Leitham, because Lord Leitham's story, you couldn't tell it in a few minutes because it was too long. But there's other stories here, as I said, I told you about Mike Sweeney's castle. It's only a short story. And
well, we'll come to it, John.
Yes.
We'll have another day.
Another day.
We must leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.